Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, and great to see old friends in the audience. Today I want to ask this somewhat rhetorical question: are all runoff processes the same? And what I'd like to kind of lead you through is a brief history of rainfall runoff process research as it relates to soil hydrology, and then talk about why I think overland flow and subsurface storm flow are so similar. And I'll focus on this kind of sequence of filling, spilling, transmission loss along the flow path and connectivity, and then some ways forward as it might relate to modeling and prediction. And I start with an old photograph. This is Walter Langbein, after whom the AGU Langbein lecture is named. This is a photo from a textbook by Dunn and Leopold back in the 70s, just showing this kind of overland flow in a New Mexico rainstorm during the late 50s, early 1960s. So what is the status quo in this area? Well, a status quo is to think about how all runoff processes are different. So we, in this, again, very simplistic diagram, we might have infiltration excess overland flow, which is often, you know, linked to arid, subhumid climates, thin vegetation, you know, of course, where rainfall intensity exceeds soil infiltrability. And then, in a kind of a variable source way, subsurface storm flow on steeper slopes with thinner soils, saturation excess overland flow, where we might have valley bottoms or convergent areas where groundwater or perched water tables in the soil are rising to the surface to produce saturation excess overland flow. So this might be an outrageous hypothesis, going back to this paper. I don't know if you've seen this. This is a paper by William Morris Davis in 1926 in Science, The Value of Outrageous Geological Hypotheses. This was given at a Gilbert Club-like meeting at UC Berkeley. But I think that there's value in asking kind of bizarre questions like this, and I want to kind of get your reaction to maybe whether this is outrageous to say that overland flow and subsurface storm flow are indeed two sides of the same coin. So let's look at what came after that work by Langbein and Horton. Well, forest hydrologists started working in areas with where soil infiltrabilities were greatly in excess of rainfall intensities. Many sites like this one at Coweta in North Carolina. This is John Hewlett in the mid-1960s, where he repacked a trench with similar bulk densities and kind of reproduced the background soil characteristics and looked at the hydrologic response. And most of the flow then was along this soil-bedrock interface. And here he was really rejecting this whole paradigm of overland flow and went on a mission through his career to kind of really reject infiltration excess as a runoff-producing mechanism in forest land. But really it was focused on water flow at the soil bedrock interface in that sloping soil tube. This is a site in Georgia in the southeast United States where I've been working for some time. It's a USGS site. And here you can see in a real soil, if you like, the very different conditions to this kind of repack column with a perfectly smooth concrete liner. The soil bedrock interface, or in this case perhaps soil saprolite interface, is very irregular, despite the fact that the surface topography is fairly smooth. And here's a trench along the base of this slope. And I've shown this next slide, many times before, but I just want to use it to illustrate this point on similarity, overland flow, subsurface storm flow. So when we look at the runoff response for the slope, the one from the map, the previous slide, what do we see? These are wells completed down at that soil saprolite interface, and during different storms of different sizes, each one getting bigger, these are all separate rainfall runoff events, we see different patches or blobs of saturation, perched water table down at that soil bedrock interface. So your 16 millimeter event, here's a larger event. And it's not until we get to about 55 or 60 millimeters of rainfall do we get connectivity to the base of the soil of the hill slope. And as a result, here's a bigger event. So this is connectivity. So the idea is that we need saturation in the soil profile as a precondition for lateral flow. And what we're seeing then is this kind of filling and spilling of these depressions down at that soil bedrock interface, with the upshot being once we exceed that threshold, here around 50 or 60 millimeters, then we can turn on this hill slope. We produce lateral flow. And this is very different then to that concrete trough model, because it all comes down to the microtopographic roughness and the holding back of those patches of saturation at an interface. Now, I'm not saying this applies everywhere, but when we go to different catchments, as I'll show you in a moment, we see expressions of this in different settings in different ways. If we go back to these data now and say, well, why isn't it a straighter line here after we reach after we reach that threshold? What we see is that rainfall intensity on the y-axis and antecedent moisture on the x-axis, these dots are all the rainfall runoff points in our record. So these are all different events that we monitored at this hill slope. And the red is outlining the magnitude of the runoff generation. So these are the only events that produced flow at the scale of the whole hill slope when connectivity was achieved. And you can see it either needs to be wet in terms of antecedent soil moisture, or we need to have rain intensities that are getting up around or over 25 millimeters an hour. This is also rather different, because if you go back to Hewlett and Hibbert, they would say rainfall intensity in a subsurface storm flow environment is the last thing you need to look at. Now, when we go to other sites, this is the Mai Mai site in New Zealand, looking at the same kind of plot. Each dot represents a different rainfall runoff event. Here's total storm runoff on the y-axis versus precipitation. Now that threshold, rather than being 55 or 60 millimeters of total storm rainfall, is down around 20. Here's a site in South Carolina, so very, very flat coastal plain soils over an argillic horizon, and here we need to get up to almost like a tropical cyclone at 150 millimeters to generate lateral flow. But in all cases, at least the ones that I've looked at with these red dots where we've done trenching and the like, it all comes down to very similar sequence. We get this filling of depressions at the soil bedrock interface, or a soil till interface, or a soil saprolite interface. We get some spilling if there's some connectivity to the next bump. We get loss along that flow path, so transmission loss, that then is deep percolation. And then we have, if we connect them all up, we'll get connectivity. And this can be from the top of the slope to the bottom of the slope, or the bottom slope up as a saturated wedge. It all depends on what that spatial pattern might be of the soil depth mantled across that hill slope. Now, 2 years ago, I moved to Saskatchewan, where it's a rather different hydrological environment to Pacific Rim sites where I've been working. And here, the situation looks rather different from a runoff generation point of view. This is a photo by Michael Chu at North Dakota State, but showing similar kinds of runoff generation. Of course, it's at the surface. And here, as I would stare at these kind of hill slopes, it really looks like filling and spilling. You get depressions in the soil surface topography now, not masked by the soil profile. You get connection to the next patch of saturation. You're getting transmission losses through the soil profile. And if you connect it up, you see connectivity at the scale of the hill slope. Here's a 52-year data set that we have from the Swift Current soil research site. This is a 5-hectare plot. We have three of them now. And over this 52 years, we have flow from the outlet of this 5-hectare field. This is flow generated exclusively by infiltration excess, either during rain events or during snow melt, during spring melt. And this is total storm precipitation on the x-axis. Again, a fairly clear threshold for generation of flow off of this plot, but quite messy after the threshold is met. And if we look at this, if we interrogate this 52-year record, this is work of one of my students, Anna Coles, where we've done kind of a classification and regression tree CART approach. Much of the kind of the first decision, if you like, in terms of runoff in the springtime, where snowmelt is really dominating the hydrology of this kind of environment. It's fairly low annual precipitation on the order of 350, 400 millimeters, most of which occurs as snow, blowing snow. Much of the condition is set up in the previous fall. So did the soil freeze under high soil moisture conditions, or was it fairly dry prior to freeze-up? This, of course, really affects the infiltrability of the soil profile at the onset of the melt period, and this is then related after, if we do have frozen ground conditions that are wet, then it really relates to the snow water equivalent in terms of the runoff ratio per unit time. So this is rather more complicated than is it just rain intensity or antecedent moisture condition, but still I think there's a way to explore the hierarchy of these controls in this kind of threshold dominated runoff type of process. And when we think of, you can imagine in an overland flow sense very clearly the transmission losses as you have overland flow to the unsaturated zone below. But the same thing is happening in the soil where we're getting filling up these depressions at the soil bedrock interface with percolation kind of localized on these zones in the soil profile, these depressions. And we've done irrigation experiments, this one at the Savannah River site in South Carolina, where we've tried to explore this kind of filling and loss deeper down into the profile. If we look at data from an experiment like this, here's time on the x-axis. On the y-axis, we have our flow rate in red and our application of the rain using one of these sprinkling experiments is a square wave up to about 8 millimeters per hour. And what you can see is we have enormous loss, enormous transmission loss, something that's very difficult to quantify under natural events, where the red line is then the trench flow at the slope base, with the difference being what's gone into the argillic horizon from these zones, even through this kind of filling and spilling process. So again, I think very similar to the overland flow context. I think one other factor that we found, particularly when excavating soils from hill slopes to explore this soil bedrock or soil saprolite or soil subsoil interface, is the extreme anisotropy in these systems. Here we've taken the soil away chunk by chunk as we move up slope, all the while in doing deuterated water and dye water injections. And what we find are lateral velocities of the tracer at that soil bedrock interface on the order of 10 to 25 meters per hour. So these are zones that are often very, very important for lateral flow down at that interface. And this is trying to expose what this might look like. This is at the Mai Mai site in New Zealand, and this is a compacted conglomerate underneath a yellow-brown earth and just showing some of the organization at that level. This is where the action is happening in the subsurface, I would argue, in zones that are producing rapid subsurface storm flow. And then as you go to different sites in a kind of a subsurface storm flow setting, from fairly flat sites to steeper sites, you're then affecting this balance of filling and spilling. If you're in a very low-angled site, like our Savannah River site in South Carolina, well, there's much more filling than there is spilling. We have small lakes forming down at that soil bedrock interface before we generate lateral flow. Whereas if we go to a site like I just showed you, there's very little filling at all. It's just spilling all the time off of that surface. So this is a way to kind of think about this balance of filling and spilling. Again, I think very analogous to what we see at the soil surface in zones that are producing infiltration excess overland flow. Okay, so let me try to put this together in a way that maybe you can react to. So here's what I think might unite these forms of runoff generation. We have a surface. That could be the soil surface, like the one I showed you in North Dakota. It could be the soil bedrock interface at the Panola site in Georgia. What really, I think, is driving the lateral runoff generation is this filling and spilling linked to these patches of saturation, linked to how permeability the layer underneath is. We've done a lot of modeling work trying to understand how that ratio of subsoil permeability to soil permeability influences the production of this saturation, just like in how infiltrability might influence the production or not of infiltration excess overland flow. In all forms, there seems to be a very strong threshold that relates to this connectivity. But of course, by the time we get to the small catchment scale, this is really smoothed out and smeared into the catchment hydrograph here. But in each case, I think there is emergent behavior to explore. So you might be asking then, well, at this point, what is the role of soil from a runoff generation point of view? And I think a lot of this relates to how it influences this filtering of getting water down to the interface that is responsible for the generation of runoff. So here we're going back to this site in Georgia, and I'm going to take a distributed conceptual runoff model, basically a cell-to-cell water routing model. I won't tell you much about it because I don't have time. Here's the subsurface storm flow on the y-axis in response to this rainfall event, and this is covering a few days in February in 2002. So the measured data from the trench is in red, and if we take that model and we give it the measured average soil depth for that slope, so we do a kind of a Hewlett and Hibbert, we say the soil depth is uniform across that domain based on our measured average of soil depth across that domain. The blue line is what the model is able to reproduce in terms of flow. We can't get any flow out of the hill slope. If we give it the spatially distributed mapped soil depth, we're now in the model, we can represent that filling and spilling because we have shallow soil that's filling before the very deep sequence of soil. Soil depth varies here from just around zero at a bedrock outcrop to maybe 2 meters, but it's averaging about 60 centimeters. If we give it the actual soil map soil depth, we can get this line in black. So we can do a reasonable job, although we're not perfect here on the recession. But if we say we won't give it the exact soil depth, but we'll give it statistical realizations of that soil, meaning we know the correlation length scale of that soil depth variability, we know what the standard deviation is, and we give it different realizations in gray, we can do a much better job than we could if we just assumed a uniform soil depth in producing lateral subsurface storm flow. So I think this is a key role of soil. It's this, it's the filter distribution across that interface of interest. Now, as I get maybe a little more out on a limb scientifically, let's explore this with percolation. We can use percolation theory. Colleagues of Danny's at ETH, Lehman et al. Have shown that for the Panola hill slope that percolation theory can be useful. But we can bring a directed percolation approach where we're actually preserving the topographic characteristics of that surface, whether it's the surface or the subsurface, and we can do things like represent not only the threshold for the generation of flow, but we can look at these patterns of saturation that are really just this simple equation where we're looking at average over cell soil depth and soil water content to create a kind of a probability of whether we have saturation at a cell. And I think this is an approach that we're using now to start to explore the similarities and differences. Of course, there are some differences between overland flow and subsurface storm flow. The last crazy example is work by colleagues at University of Waterloo, Ali Emily, a recent PhD grad, and James Craig, who's a fluid mechanics professor and does groundwater modeling. And here we're asking the question, could we reproduce these data? We're focusing on this data set again. But now we're going to compare what many of you will recognize as Darcy Richards here above, where we're taking now a very physics-based approach to modeling the subsurface storm flow, if you like, not this kind of rules-based approach in percolation. And we're comparing this to a depth average St. Venant equation, where we're using kind of zero inertia assumptions, and we're using here, we're going to use Manning's roughness as a way to get at what the hydraulic conductivity would be in terms of roughness or kind of slowing down this surface flow. So we're going to compare the Darcy Richards with this diffusive wave approach for the same hill slope where we have the soil intact, and here we've removed the soil, and we're doing this crazy thing by applying an overland flow model to that subsurface interface. And amazingly, we get very similar kinds of responses. These are uncalibrated models now using Darcy Richards and the diffusive wave approach. Again, of course, not perfect, and we're not using this to make predictions. We're using the model as a hypothesis-generating tool or a learning tool. But it's telling us that this type of approach to subsurface storm flow could have some merit. Why? Because this is running in seconds. This is running in hours for the same experiment. This could guide, perhaps, ways to go about mapping interfaces, going around looking at some of the things that affect the pattern of filling and spilling, rather than perhaps an additive model in a more traditional Darcy Richards-based approach. Now, I'm not saying I'm throwing Darcy Richards' baby out with the bathwater, but I think it is worth exploring this kind of interface flow and this, again, perceived similarity between overland flow and subsurface storm flow. So just to come back to the question then, maybe Horton and Hewlett weren't all that different. And I guess what I'm saying is that what we're seeing at depth is quite analogous to what we'd see in terms of precipitation, infiltrability, and in terms of lateral flow at the soil surface or in the subsurface. And to summarize then, I guess this focus on differences, I think we could learn something by exploring perhaps some of the similarities, particularly in the case of overland flow having visible boundary conditions, and we're exploring this in Saskatchewan. And again, this kind of sequence of filling, spilling, transmission loss, and connectivity, and thinking about whether or not this might afford new ways forward for modeling and prediction. Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Did you mention some of the stuff on the what I call the prairie pothole region?
Yes.
And then down like southern Iowa, which is the southern edge of it. What happens when you've got your dense fracture till, which is a much more extreme subsurface than the current surface? Plus, these potholes have sand lenses.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there are complexities, especially when you expand out to large scales that might include potholes. I guess I'm thinking more hill slope scales. I'm going from maybe the scale of a pedon to this room. Right. Well, we have catchments with potholes, and I think I understand what you're saying. In our region, at least, most of the runoff is happening during spring melt, and it's snow melting onto frozen ground. And the frozen ground is either frozen wet or frozen dry or something like that, and it's really influencing how much is continuing to percolate. So if I think of that process at the scale of this room, that's the one I imagine to be similar to kind of filling and spilling at these hill slopes, which are also kind of the scale of this room or two times the size of the room. But certainly, when you zoom out to a catchment scale that would include other geomorphic units in an upland catchment, you know, with riparian zones, perhaps hollows, absolutely, there are other, you know, other geomorphic features that are affecting the sequencing or blend of water into the stream. Here, I'm really trying to make this small leap from the kind of scale of the podium to the scale of the room. Yeah.
My experience is, I agree with you, it's often that subsurface topography that generates on field slopes. My concern with the simplistic approach of just filling the sphere and filling up the depressions is the connectivity of the soil pipes and the macropores.
Yeah.
Are you assuming that the two are associated together?
Yeah, I am. And I've not really made a explicit connection to preferential flow. But in many of these slopes where I've worked, so at the trenches, we're plumbing individual soil pipes often. And those soil pipes are often the areas where we have the most kind of bedrock accumulated area. Certainly it was that way at the Panola site. And we've looked at soil pipe flow as separate from the maintenance flow. You know, one conundrum is at that Panola site in Georgia, the one with the detailed hill slope topography, is that about half the flow comes from two soil pipes plumbed at the base of the slope. And the really, I'd love John or others' thoughts on this, but we run a 3D Darcy Richards solver. Maybe in that case we used Tuff 2, but we also used Hydrus 3D. And we can reproduce the dynamics of the trench flow and the dynamics of 3D arrangements of recording tensiometers. But we can only represent half the flow. And the other half is pipe flow that we could never get a Darcy Richards solver to accommodate the combined pipe and trench flow and then resolve properly the matrix potential back in the hill slope. So that makes me think that maybe the pipes are fairly localized because they're not influencing the pore pressure dynamics in the soil farther up into the hill slope. But I would love to explore with anyone like yourself who might be focusing on preferential flow how to explore that. Yeah.